Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankhofer, where we talk about all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. There are many threats on the horizon, yet we cannot rely on true and accurate media coverage of many of these issues. These threats are propagated from the mainstream media seeking to tell only one side of the story. In fact, this propagation can even be considered biased propaganda. This is a legitimate threat to you, your family, and our nation, and here on Civil Defense Radio, we seek the facts that others leave out. Remember, your tomorrow may depend on today's preparedness. Now, here is your host, Preston Schlankhofer.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio. I am your host, Preston Schlankhofer, coming to you from the Strategic Command and Control Center deep within the Civil Defense Radio bunker. I have to apologize right up front. I've got a bit of a head cold, but we're going to drive on and make this thing happen. So our conversation today will draw on the expertise of one of our friends. Our guest this episode is a friend of the show and a guest back in episode 204, where we discussed the Chinese nuclear threat. David Pine Esquire is a former U.S. Army Combat Arms and Headquarters Staff Officer with a MA in National Security Studies from Georgetown University. He currently serves as the Deputy Director of National Operations for the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security and is a contributor to Dr. Peter Pry's new book, Blackout Warfare. David, welcome back to Civil Defense Radio.
Thanks so much for being on the show. It's great to be on.
Yes, it's a pleasure having you. I want to tap your expertise in a couple different areas. First, I want to talk about these three generals that have put this really partisan shot across the bow of the 2024 election and really calls into question what the hard left plans to do to our military, even further purging it of diverse thought. But then I want to talk about your take on this new article you have coming out and some of the things that you have written in there. So let's start off with these generals, and this thing is just crazy. What are your thoughts on this, just to start off with?
Well, I mean, I think it all started with the, kind of the mutiny that we had, the stealth coup attempt that was led by General Mark Milley, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he was interviewed for a recent book in which he basically said, you know, he called together the military heads, the heads of the various armed services into one of the bunkers near the White House and said, you're taking your orders from me now. I'm in charge. You know, I'm basically in charge of our nuclear arsenal. Even though I'm not even in the chain of command for that, and took various other measures to undermine the President of the United States, suggesting that he would be willing to kind of lead a military coup against the President if he did not step down. And since then, of course, with the Biden administration, what we've seen is, kind of, I call it the Sovietization of the U.S. military, in that it is being purged of political opponents of the Biden regime. In disturbing ways. And they're using, you know, various U.S. military officers as kind of like the old Soviet example at political commissars kind of root out any political opposition within the military. And that is something that's been raised by retired Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, who I believe served in Congress. And, it's very disturbing. And, you know, the generals, these three generals are, you know, kind of that same mindset that, you know, we may face, you know, political opposition in the military that could rise to the level of a military coup against Biden if he were to, you know, or whatever Democrat is reelected to the White House.
Yeah, they warn that the election of 2024 could have its own insurrection or even civil war and another coup attempt. So what they're actually saying to me is they're projecting. One, they're basically saying that it's a lock for the Democrats and whoever they have in that candidate. And so Trump will automatically lose, or any other Republican will automatically lose to the leftist designee. So it's something that they are basically telling everybody, it's done. Don't even try.
Yeah. It's all very Orwellian because, of course, as you and I know, there was massive evidence of fraud, much of which, you know, with the collusion of the communist Chinese, who, there's a Dominion voting machines, of course, are owned by a Chinese holding company, which purchased it a month before the election. And there's considerable evidence that they may have helped the Democrats steal the election from Donald Trump, which was, kind of their main goal of last year was to overthrow President Trump and replace him with their preferred presidential candidate, Joe Biden, who President Xi, Chinese President Xi, refers to as an old friend. Old friend, the term old friend is a code word for kind of the pro-communist Chinese establishment that had typically led this country, and has really worked to strengthen China's economy and for the past 2 to 3 decades.
Yeah. Well, these three generals, they're apparently part of this war gaming that took place before the 2020 election called the Transition Integrity Project, which was touted as a saving grace for our election integrity and all this by the leftist Time magazine. Basically, what it was an admission of vote stealing and the corruption that happened that they're trying to say didn't happen. And these people are just beyond the pale, trying to project their thoughts and ambitions and things onto us and make us look like the bad guys when they're the ones who are actually stealing this nation and turning it into something that it's not meant to be. I mean, so this environment we're in, we may see ourselves in a civil war like what they are talking about, but we also have other threats out there that may put us into World War III, which would negate even worrying about a civil war, right?
Yeah, I mean, the objective, these generals are just playing into the Russian and Chinese, information warfare efforts to divide our country in very extreme ways and unprecedented ways that we haven't seen since the Civil War. You know, they believe that by dividing, the American people against each other, dividing the military against each other, dividing, the states against each other, that it will be that much easier for them to defeat the United States and potentially take us over, occupy, both of our coasts. After an EMP cyber or limited nuclear attack or strike?
You know, I've got a little bit of experience in psychological operations. And this, to me, I don't see these guys as being dupes to communist propaganda. I see these people as being in on the game. It's not something that they're too sophisticated to be duped into this and not see what they're doing is counter the Constitution, but they're just in it for themselves.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Again, it's so Orwellian because here they are claiming to be fulfilling their oath to protect and defend the Constitution when they're doing the exact opposite.
Yeah.
You know, our constitutional republic is founded upon, Republican values. And one of those Republican values is kind of one man, one vote. They're, voter integrity, the idea that, vote stealing isn't permitted in the country, and that each state kind of whatever their majority vote will be properly applied to the Electoral College to elect a new president. And that didn't happen in the last election, and there was incredible evidence of up to 6 million votes being stolen, and especially to turn the tide, at least in that we know of, in five or six key battleground states, three of which would have been sufficient to elect Donald Trump president.
Yes. Now, this all leads to the subject of your latest piece that's going to be published here real soon. You sent out an advanced copy to a lot of us. Biden should negotiate peace agreement with Russia to avert war with Ukraine. It's a very interesting piece, but it also brings China into the game. And it's very strategic how you wrote this. Can you give us a brief overview, and then we'll go into how some of the more nuanced aspects of it?
Yeah. So for the past quarter century or so, I've been advocating increasingly online, in terms of publications, but I've been supporting the idea that we need to do everything we can to divide the Sino-Russian alliance. Russia and China have been formal allies ever since they included a military pact called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was founded in July 2001, following their signing of a Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation. And Vladimir Putin has referred to this this organization as a reborn Warsaw Pact. China and Russia are now openly calling each other allies, and yet we have this denial in Washington. You know, that our national security, I say, quote unquote, experts,
right,
are telling us that the China and Russia will never be allies. Their interests are too divergent. They're at best cooperating out of convenience, but they'll never engage in joint attacks or coordinated attacks on the United States. All evidence the contrary. So the purpose of this piece that's being published in the National Interest on Saturday is, you know, it's a strategy for what we can do, you know, short of military attack or war, is, you know, to divide this alliance, which in terms of a comparison to our military capabilities, overmatches us in almost every area. As you know, in terms of nuclear weapons, they have twice as many strategic nuclear weapons than we do. They have maybe six times as many non-strategic weapons, actually quite many times more than that. You know, in terms of economic power, Russia is more powerful than the U.S. economically, manufacturing power, and then there, of course, nuclear hypersonics, of which we have none and are developing none, hypersonic weapons that are nuclear armed, EMP weapons, where they have supremacy over us. We have no super EMP weapons under development, cyber weapons. We're players in that, but our cyber defense capabilities are very low, very limited, whereas China has kind of a closed loop internet that protects them from cyber attack. And Russia, I think, is building something similar. So there's a lot of the idea that we could win a war against Russia and Ukraine, or that we could fight and win a war against China and Taiwan is really almost laughable, because, you know, they have those countries border on their, you know, on their nations, and they have regional military superiority over us. And their interest in acquiring, you know, kind of reacquiring these lost territories is, you know, they consider those their red line, their top vital interests, number one national security interests, much as if we were to lose Texas.
Right.
If we were to lose Texas, that would be our primary national security interest, would be to reunite our country and retake it back. And so Putin is playing, you know, he's playing for keeps. He's by all reports, it appears that he is planning to invade Ukraine in January, February, and no later than April of 2022. And so the only way to stop him, it's not going to be by military threats. It's not going to be by, you know, threats of economic sanctions that haven't worked in the past. He's given us essentially, it's been called a diplomatic ultimatum, but it's his bottom line, I believe, is that if we agree to something very similar to what he's offered in terms of the security agreement he's offered to the U.S. and NATO, then war will be averted, I believe. And if we don't, if we fall considerably short and say, well, these key terms are unacceptable, then he'll call off negotiations and say, hey, I gave peace a chance, but then we're going to war. And so that's what we need to avert. I think this is an opportunity. You know, I think Donald Trump was elected president to try to make peace with Russia, and he was completely sabotaged by the deep state and his Democrat opposition in his attempts to do that with the whole Trump-Russia collusion hoax. But Biden, you know, of course, Biden can pursue this, do the same things that Trump did and get zero repercussions from the Democrats because the Democrats are hypocrites.
To say the least.
So, you know, I mean, he could give away this, you know, quote unquote, give away the store or appear to Putin, and he wouldn't get impeached over it. And so he's a little bit politically insulated, I think. I mean, certainly the Russians would, or the Republicans, our Republican friends, of which I'm one, are probably the ones that would be most opposed to the idea that we would accommodate Russia and China in any way. But, you know, a lot of people might disagree, but I believe that both world wars were started, became world wars because of the great power alliance system.
Mm.
Both the wars in Serbia, between Austria and Serbia, and Russia in World War One, and then with Poland and Germany, Nazi Germany in World War Two, you know, those would have remained regional wars, essentially between Russia and Germany and their allies. Western Europe would have stayed out. The U.S. would have stayed out. And kind of NATO is threatening to do the same thing with us. If I know that you know, the Russia has designs on the Baltic states. They want to either have them as neutral countries outside of NATO, which is essentially what Putin's proposing, or they likely will try to invade them and retake them back by force. You know, it would behoove us to make that, you know, make that concession to Putin to have them detached from NATO and walk in return for a guarantee for their neutrality, or else to leave NATO entirely, which I think is would be a pretty good deal if we could get Russia and China to break up their alliance. A U.S. withdrawal from NATO while we continue to guarantee Western Europe and Japan and the Western Hemisphere, I think would be a deal worth taking.
Now, how would that work? We are the biggest military source and the biggest money man, bag man in the NATO alliance. So I don't see much leadership out of the Europeans. All it is appeasement on that side. I mean, it seems like they're all French and they're all bending over.
Well, again, it's not as clear cut as that. And you know, let me say that I supported Patton's call to take the war to the Soviets in 1945. I think that was a real lost opportunity. We had military superiority over Russia, the Soviets. We shortly after the end of the European War, we developed atomic weapons. We had atomic supremacy. We could have defeated the Soviets and very easily, I think, with moderate losses, could have liberated Eastern Europe from the Soviets in 1945. During the Cold War was mostly fought, at least in terms of the Korean and Vietnam Wars, were fought in a world defined by U.S. nuclear superiority. Today, we face the exact opposite. We have the world is now defined by Sino-Russian military nuclear superiority and EMP supremacy. And in that type of environment, they can move conventionally. They can invade other countries with little to any fear of a U.S. nuclear response, knowing that, you know, we're a lot weaker than they are. And they could take us down, you know, comparative ease compared to the Cold War days. So in that type of environment, there are trade-offs. Your options are limited. Just like if you have a limited amount of money versus someone who's wealthy, your options are limited. Your choices are limited. And so we have a lot of bad choices. Kind of the policy that I'm advocating is the least bad policy, the one that is most likely to guarantee that U.S. vital interests are secured, that we do not provoke a EMP cyber nuclear attack, biological attack on the U.S. homeland, and that we can remain at peace with Russia and China while we try to rebuild our nuclear deterrent and, you know, harden the grid and build a comprehensive national missile defense system.
Now, your article says that we've had our alert status raised to DEFCON 3, which is Defense Condition 3. That's not happened before, right?
It has happened before, but only a few times. And it's happened with increasing frequency under the Biden administration. There have been two times that we have had our alert status raised to DEFCON 3. The first time was in 19... Well, first of all, let me just explain. The DEFCON system was designed in 1957, and it is primarily essentially a reading of U.S. leaders' belief in the likelihood of nuclear attack upon the United States. So if you read it that way, you know, we're normally at DEFCON 4 or 5. We've been at DEFCON 4 primarily during the war on terror. And so we're that much closer to potential nuclear war with Russia and or China. But the only times we've been at DEFCON 3 in our history since 1957 have been the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which also saw our Strategic Air Command alert status raised briefly to DEFCON 2, and then 9/11. And then last April, when Russia started massing troops, 100,000 troops along Ukraine's borders. And then for the past 24 to 25 days, the past 3.5 weeks, we've been at DEFCON 3. Now, there have been I have heard reports that this is kind of posturing by the Biden administration. They're using the DEFCON 3 alert status to kind of send a signal to Russia, because they don't have very few cards to play to get Russia's attention, that we mean business, and that we would possibly be willing to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. I think that's a dangerous game, because, you know, Putin has a lot more cards to play. He's stated repeatedly, when asked, you know, how he would respond if his security agreements are rejected. He said that he has a number of, Russia has a myriad of options, but if they would be military responses, that would be utilized. He calls them military technical responses, which to me is a little bit ominous, because military technical, you know, kind of to me indicates EMP cyber, kind of the type of scenarios that Peter Pry, yourself, and myself and the EMP task force have been most concerned about.
Yeah, that's very concerning in that respect. You know, while you were talking, it reminded me that when Trump came into office, he was told by Obama that, you know, war with Russia is very close. And that there was also something that if Hillary would have won, she would have taken us to war with Russia. You think Russia is being goaded here by the Biden administration, who's actually probably being led by Obama himself?
So I'm not sure in answer to both those questions. I have to say that I do not believe that Obama is behind the Biden White House. I think he has an influence, certainly, but most Republican congressmen, if you were to ask them, would say they refer to his chief of staff, Ron Klein, as the prime minister, kind of the power behind the throne, much even to a greater extent than Dick Cheney was driving the George W. Bush White House.
Uh-huh.
I don't see any conspiracy on the part of the deep state to get us in a war with Russia. I really don't think that that's part of their plan. I don't see how that would advance their objectives. I think they really believe that, you know, the U.S. is still the most powerful superpower in the block out of the three. I don't see any evidence for that being the case anymore. If ever it has been, as I said, we had nuclear superiority up until maybe the early 1970s. And then, you know, Russia eventually obtained kind of a small level of superiority over us in the 80s. And it's only accelerated with all of these arms control treaties, which have seen the unilateral disarmament of 94% of our nuclear arsenal, including, I think, about 76 to 80% of our strategic nuclear weapons.
So how do you see a future with us and Russia in some kind of an alliance? How would that look, and what would Russia have to give up?
So I don't, you know, that Peter Pry and I have talked about at length about how great it would be if the U.S. and Russia could be allies. We think that, you know, our differences are not so great that we couldn't come to terms along the lines that I've outlined here in this article, as well as Peter's upcoming article. You know, that would serve to effectively deter China from attacking us. Realistically speaking, you know, there are chances of Russia going to war with China, if we were attacked by China, are slim to none, as I believe the chances of, if, you know, if Russia were to be attacked by China, the chances of us, you know, risking nuclear war with China over that would be very, very minimal. And thus, kind of the more realistic scenario and a more limited, you know, objective would be to merely achieve neutrality for Russia, you know, in any conflict with China. And so, again, the limited objective being the breaking up of the Sino-Russian alliance, and the creation of what I believe is a much more stable and secure international order, which would be a tripolar international order, in which there's Russia, China, and the U.S. exist, but none of them are allies. They're all rivals, and they're all kind of competing against each other, but they all have their own spheres of influence. And each superpower, our regional hegemon, respects and does not cross the red lines of the other spheres of influence. We had a sphere of influence agreement that was negotiated mostly by Winston Churchill at Yalta and at the Fourth Moscow Conference in 1944 and 1945. And it kept the nuclear peace and the peace in Europe for about half a century. In that we didn't cross into their sphere, Russia's sphere of influence, until I think 1997, when we admitted three Warsaw Pact countries into NATO. And that's something that was problematic from the start. And I think it was a huge mistake to extend NATO into Eastern Europe, and especially the former Soviet Union. And I don't believe we would be at risk of war today had we not made that critical mistake in the 90s.
Makes sense. A friend of mine, he's an intelligence analyst, and he works for a major agency, and he's a Russia phobe. He agrees along the lines of you and how Russia is more aligned with us than with the Chinese, and how we should be getting along better. He and I have had discussions on this quite a few times, and I think he would... entirely endorse your article that you have coming out here. And what magazine is that?
It's the National Interest. It's www.nationalinterest.org. And I'll be coming out on Saturday morning, I've told.
Okay. And you have multiple articles in that publication, right?
Yeah, I've published a number of articles, including a couple of articles along these lines, one of which kind of covered a sphere of influence proposal that focused both on Russia and China, whereas this one is primarily focused on Russia, given the Ukraine crisis that we're having right now.
Okay. And we're about out of time. Is there anything else that you wanted to relay to our guests out there, our listening audience?
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously we're members of the EAP Task Force, and, you know, we just need to do a lot more to get grassroots support, people, you know, citizens who are really focused on national security, to contact members of Congress and to let them know that they strongly support, you know, doubling the size of our nuclear turret, massively increasing our missile defense arsenal. And then, of course, hardening the grid and our critical infrastructure against EMP and cyber attack. Those are three different things that need to happen as soon as possible to, you know, kind of build back our strength so we can get on a more equal footing with the Sino-Russian alliance. And as well, you know, tell them that to support a peaceful diplomatic solution with Russia. You know, Russia and China, I don't want to confuse your listeners. Russia and China are close military allies, and they have a lot more in common right now than we do with Russia. You know, the U.S. does with Russia. And the reason for that is we've been continually encroaching upon their spheres of influence. You know, we regularly have exercises, naval exercises in the Black Sea, the Baltic Sea. We send, you know, warships, cruisers and destroyers through the Taiwan Straits, all of which have little more effect than just really ticking off our enemies and getting them to align together and ally together and want to destroy us. And Russian President Putin, he believes war with the U.S. is inevitable, and he's been preparing Russia for an EMP cyber nuclear war with the U.S. for the past 20 years. But I don't believe it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable if we continue the same foolish national security policies and foreign policies. But I think if we were to kind of shake up the things a little bit and adopt, you know, abandon our failed suicidal national security strategy of liberal hegemony, you know, where we're trying to defend every country along Russia and China's borders, whether it's a vital interest or not, and, you know, pursue something much more realistic that puts America first. And I just want to say that I believe the overriding interest, the national security interest of, and the duty of every elected official in this country at the federal level is to protect, defend, and preserve the United States of America and the lives of our citizens. And if you think about defending the Baltics, for example, or defending Ukraine or defending Taiwan, how does that advance that overriding national security priority of preserving and protecting the United States and its citizens? And the answer is it doesn't. It does the exact opposite. So we need to have a discussion that, you know, where we decide what are our vital interests. I believe our vital interests are confined to the Western Hemisphere, Western Europe, and Japan, and keeping other countries from conquering those areas or encroaching on those areas. But outside of that, I think we can find compromise. And I think if we were to satisfy the vital interests of both Russia and China, but particularly Russia, I think we could ensure the great power nuclear peace, EMP peace, for half a century to come.
That's awesome. And that'll have to be the last word. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in, like a civil war or World War III. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. And be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook, Telegram, MeWe, and YouTube. And please like and share our podcast here, because the algorithms are king when we're trying to move this thing around. The more likes we have, the better. The more it's shared, the better. These algorithms, man, they're killing us because we don't have enough of you guys sharing these and liking our podcasts and or even comment. So please do so. And I want to thank Dave Pry again for being on our show. And I want to thank you, our friends who are with us on a regular basis. We really appreciate you being here. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.